What kind of mother season are you?
I'm a fall mother. Yeah, I think I'm definitely a fall mother. I think it's because I'm a Virgo and I like structure and I love that back to school feeling and I'm really into mothering, even though I resent all of the things that society kind of imposes on you. So yeah, it helps me to have routine and structure. So I'm a fall mother. Good question.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Sophia Shalmiev about Mother Winter. This interview was made possible with the generous support of the Montana Book Festival. This interview addresses violence against women and girls. Listener discretion is advised.
On the jacket of your book, it notes, the story is an arresting, impassioned account that is equal parts refugee coming-of-age tale, feminist manifesto, and a meditation on motherhood, displacement, gender politics, and art. This book holds so much. So I want to know a bit about the process. You know, how and when did you know it was going to take this shape? And, you know, was there a particular moment when it started to come together?
Right. I mean, in terms of craft, I got an MFA and I was doing that MFA while I was nursing my daughter in class and taking care of my, at the time, 4, then 5, then 6-year-old at home. And so I kind of just did everything from scraps. Like I sort of made this thing in a very fight or flight, immigrant mentality. Shtetl, put the thing in your, you know, one stuffed bag and run with it kind of way. And so I was really writing in fits and starts. Like I would get home, I would make dinner, I would nurse the baby. I knew she'd be asleep for 3 hours. So then I would run away to the coffee shop and I would put something down. And I was just constantly in this sort of dream state of recording things. I was really heavily influenced by Bernadette Mayer, who is an incredible poet, who is also a mother who wrote a book, it's not a coincidence, about her one day, the shortest day of the year, so it's midwinter. It's a poem about the entire day. So she's raising children while her husband, who's also a poet, is just kind of on the floor doing his own thing. And she's taking in the grocery store and doing all the things and writing this epic poem that turned out to be a whole entire book. She was kind of an experimental poet. Very, very influenced by her and also influenced by Riot Girl, 90s political activism and manifestos and just that appreciation for the moment, like seizing the moment and dealing with the dismantling the hierarchies in front of you right then and there. So as I was sort of being this subservient, basic mother that I had to be because my children don't know any better, they don't care about politics, I also can like write down the ways that it was submerging me in a hot, hot cauldron of water.
In terms of content, the book chronicles you're leaving the USSR at age 11 and losing track of your mother for good. And then maybe the mid-years and early part of your adulthood. I want to know if you can speak directly to the relationship between your, I'm calling it displacement, but I don't know if that's the right word, between your displacement from your mom and displacement from USSR at the time.
Right. So for me, a sense of place, that's really hard. Just in general, I write about that in the book. To write place, to be right with a place is really hard. I'm fortunate that for now, at least, I've been in Portland or the Pacific Northwest has felt like a real home for me, partially because like I just really became invested in my children having this stable structure and doing it for them. And so if I do it for them, then I could do it for myself. But in terms of being displaced from my mom, I think it's only now that I am kind of realizing how in writing and in my relationships, I'm trying to master and remaster and rewrite that very strange kind of abandonment where it's not that she necessarily said goodbye and abandoned me, like a passive abandonment of alcoholism. You know, it's that kind of narcissism. It's really hard to be mad at somebody about. And then the being stolen away from her. So then I get to kind of be mad at my dad, the constant, the consistent, the kind of good enough center, even though he was incredibly flawed, the parent that stayed. And so now I'm in this place where I'm again realizing how I choose or don't choose people who can't be there for me or can't give me what I need, and then put that into the writing because the writing does help me sort that out.
In terms of the ambiguous loss you suffered, you write, born in January 1956, Elena was a true Russian winter mother. You'll never know how bad she'll be or when she's coming or going. Is there something inherently disorganizing then about a mother loss that defies a straightforward narrative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in general. And I love kind of more like vaudevillian regressive writing and in some ways living too. Like I look up to Iggy Pop, for example, and I resent the fact that the world can't hold a female Iggy Pop. So I think that having no mother and having no way of finding her and having no answers and having that as your inconsolable loss, and for me personally, knowing that I choose partners who stonewall, like I choose partners who have no answers in general, even if sometimes they're kind, deeply generous, sweet, interesting men, or sometimes even best friends. But for me, like I'm a seeker, I'm really detail oriented. I want to dig down. And they're just not going to do that. These are people who are into avoidance and redirection. And so I think then in the writing, I know that I could probe things that I can't through people. You know what I mean? And so I don't have to go after the people as hard because I get to do that in the art. And then in terms of the Iggy Pop thing I said, in terms of inconsolable loss and wanting to be a little bit more of a child, I think what it really means to not have a mother is that you didn't get to have a childhood. So then, as I say in the book, like you kind of can't get a childhood back, but you can continuously act like a child. And I don't know what that says for our American men who are the majority are men babies, and the women step up to the plate and are constantly mothering them, whether or not they had a childhood or not, believe it or not. Like I've never got a pass. Like I could never get away with anything. But I did always dream that I could go off the rails, that I can cut my chest open on stage like Iggy Pop does, that I can be slutty and irreverent and curse and just be kind of smutty and get away with it. But it's not the case. There are high, high prices to pay for acting like a little girl.
What I love about what I just witnessed across from me is you display the type of moves you do in the book, which is blending like deep intellect and references to all kinds of art mentors, I might call, and then also making the associative leaps that you do throughout the book. And again, I just want you to try and name, because the book is, I'm calling it sort of like a lyric memoir. I mean, it is very lyrical, and you move between modes and places and art pieces really fluidly and beautifully. And I just want to know like your level of awareness and consciousness around that art form, you know, how do you do it?
To be a collector like that, I don't know why anybody's mind works the way it does. And there's some incredibly, incredibly lyrical writers who are not gatherers and collectors the way that I am. I was actually thinking a lot about this panel that I had yesterday where we're talking about memoir and a sense of place. And questions came up about me being an immigrant, and a Native American man was talking to me in terms of my identity as an immigrant when somebody asked me the question, who are you then, like nationality or whatever? And I said, well, I'm deeply American, and I'm deeply American only because of American feminism, specifically lesbian feminists and Black feminists and not radical second wave feminists, but more, you know, 90s feminism, and writers like Eileen Miles, who just kind of pissed on it all, was just like so incredible. And this man said to me that, you know, in a way, like it's maybe they're offensive, or I can't be deeply American because I really do have a place that I am from or can go back to. And these things are all true. And then I thought, well, holy crap. Though, as a woman, though, we could not own property for ever. Never could we ever own property. If our father owned something, we had to marry a man, then he took over that property. And so we carried everything on us. So, like, women literally, like, would have to buy expensive brooches or be given brooches. Like, why do we have ornate things in our hair? Because we can literally walk away with everything on our person because we could never actually have a sense of place. So women don't have earth. They till it. They give birth to it. They take care of it. But up until very recently, and still, we just have not been able to be like, oh, these are the grapes I grow on my land, not my father's land. And so we would have these massive purses. And today we still do, you know, in the urban jungle, we use them as weapons or shields. And so we stuff everything that we possibly can in them. And so we are collectors. We are gatherers. And so because I don't have a mother and I'm obsessed with a socialist matriarchy rather than this capitalist patriarchy, which does not sustain human beings at all, I am that person who's constantly filling my purse with stuff and ideas because I don't really have somebody to call and be like, do you see me? Do you get me? Like, what do you think about me? Do you remember that one time, like, I didn't like carrots? That person doesn't exist. So I have to collect in the world maybe ideas of other people being seen and then, like, emulate that.
That takes me right to a place around feminism trauma and a handbag or a travel bag. There's a scene in the book where you're in Italy and you are a preteen and you're invited over to your father's boss's house to receive a travel bag. And you describe a pentimento rape. Mm-hmm. And my breath caught when I read it because it felt so true and so true for so many girls and women. And I just wanted you to actually describe that designation.
We are, in my view, in the 90s feminism view, and to say precisely what that meant, that was a hot time when women actually tried to get into rooms together without men and not have to define themselves in terms of that segregation and to say to each other, I was raped or my dad touched me inappropriately or I don't know what happened to me. And so that was something that I experienced as both a gift and a re-traumatization and a breakdown of a certain kind of feminism because it all just fell apart. Like none of us can hold the center. We were all just too traumatized and we're all at the time we didn't even know we were triggering each other. But I knew what that gift was. And yet, now that we're in this place of, you know, hashtags and social media and call-out culture, I think we're, again, not getting at the justice or the healing or the supports that women need. And we are just kind of recycling people in the news cycle. With the specifics of the pentimento rape, you know, it was just a craft thing, too. Like, pentimento is an Italian word. I got raped in Italy. I don't know if I could define something as exact rape if that organ did not enter my organ in this way because the man literally could not fit it in me, which is so horrendous and so scary. But because women are constantly downplaying every single one of their traumas because they're often way too shocking to believe that they could be done to a human being. So in order to believe that we're human beings, we downplay them so that we, well, maybe don't kill all men, but also like so that we could survive and have dignity. So I was saying a lot with just that one line in a way. It's, again, another ambiguity. It's something that I can't put my finger on. And I can never just say, like, yes, I was raped as a preteen. Somehow I always had to have this happened. And so that has been a loss in itself. But I think in writing the book, I kind of put that to bed, ha, and just said, like, yeah, that was a rape of a child.
Mm. And in an interview with Tin House, you had said, I hate that women must be marketed for their pain or their proximity to power, but not for their actual craft. So I want to know, how did you negotiate that in the writing and publishing process of the book?
I think the more I was asked for story, the more I was asked for background story, I think the more I would maybe write it down and then figure out a way to flip it. Dorothy Allison and other people say, you know, tell it slant. Because even though I think and believe that actually all women's stories need to be archived in whatever manner they want it to be, but a sequential order would be great. I think we need to actually catalog every single story that a woman wants to tell so that we have that history. I say, in the book, I kind of allude to this, but I say in other interviews that I do not understand why we have these war monuments, and yet we need to have a wraparound going from like Washington, D.C. all the way up to Seattle. We need an actual monument for every single woman's name etched in granite for everything that she has dealt with as a result of either sexual assault or domestic violence or some other abuse. And so it was both important to me to sort of state the facts as though I'm in a courtroom because I feel interrogated, and at the same time interrogate the reader as to why they think that they have those rights.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Sophia Shalmiev about her memoir, Mother Winter. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I was wondering if you could just read a passage for us.
Oh, I would love to. I'm going to read from page 132, something you chose, and this is, just to set you up, this is before I go back to Russia to go look for my mother. The idea to go find my mother coincided with finally receiving my American citizenship. My father had gone through the process when I left for college, but I shrugged off the responsibility even as he dutifully mailed me the naturalization applications. There would now be a death of my alien ID, which had long rendered me unable to leave the country without enormous hassle, and a birth of a passport, removing a substantial obstacle to my journey back. After being sworn in with my future travel companion, whom I had been dating for mere months, as an enthusiastic witness clapping along with the other loved ones in the back rows, I was given all the tools to apply for a passport. I could now hand grenade my body toward the place where my last passport was confiscated. I began packing even before I had the tickets, playing pretend. I didn't want to fly back either, but I wished to be brave, to be done with stillborn fantasies of our delicious reunion. I had a break from school a few months shy of my 26th birthday, some loan money, and a boyfriend who offered to come along. I didn't choose as much as succumb to the road ahead of me. It was not a hero's journey. I wanted to get it out of the way as fast as possible. A previous velleity is resignation syndrome. We all have a propensity for false pattern recognition, to look for meaning, a belief system when mystery is too anxious of a box to contain us, a story that could signify a completeness we have only felt in the darkness of our mother. We are dead stars looking up at the sky, confirms the astronomer Dr. Michelle Taller. But she's also reminding me that we are 4% of what's left after the last mass extinction, and that your children might face the threat of the next one while living on the cusp of the golden middle before a blackout. We can only observe about 4,000 stars in our night sky, but stardust collected in a jar will never make us a new planet. It is the loose bits of heat and gravity that create universes out there in the celestial wilderness, the feral, weightless darkness. But our survival depends on reading patterns, on following maps, and having a guide, a compass, a cataloged history that we believe will help us predict disasters.
You talk a lot about pattern recognition in the book, about the number four even. What's your relationship to patterns and prediction now?
Right. I really enjoy a lot of stability. So that I can sort of go off and be wild and be creative and be a mother who can hold the center. I think that as a collector and as a person who moved around a lot and who didn't feel like I had a home, it was really important for me that if I had a box of things that they had this something in common, and that something in common I impose my own meaning on it because that's something nobody else can do.
The line from that passage, "I can now hand grenade my body toward the place where my last passport was confiscated." Throughout the book, I was so struck by the quality of your voice and how it felt remarkably free from shame.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about your own sense of that.
Right. Wow, I'm a good actress because shame is my biggest motivator for everything. I am that judgy Jewish mother who I'm so hypercritical. And I, again, like I'm aware enough to not do it to my kids, but boy, I just want to do that. I just want to walk into every situation and fix it all and tell everybody what's wrong with it and do it in this ebullient, like, hand-waving manner. And I am like that with myself tenfold. In the writing, though, I am exercising this other girl woman who's got like a hand on her hip, who's got this fake bravado down to the point where it's real. I play a lot with what's fake and real. I play a lot with the woman is like the mysterious hole that we project a lot onto. And so I think it's important to employ satire, hyperbole, like all of these tools that, well, what did the Jews do after the Holocaust when they came to America? They decided to make a lot of comedies. They decided to make a lot of absurd theater to sort of manage the inhumane treatment that they had. And so I think as a girl and as a woman, I've internalized so much shame about it that I think I'm boiling over with it to the point where it actually could be theatrical and that theater serves me. But underneath it, oh God, I mean, I'm in therapy every day, but I literally wipe my head with the shame of rag with more shame sweat and more shame tears. And I put it into my shame basket that is always full.
There are moments of heartbreaking recognition, and you'll tell me if this is satire or comedy or fake or not fake, but in one of the places in the book you wrote, "I signed a contract to not recreate her and showed up for active duty armed with a toy gun. Mm-hmm. It is in me to leave my children. It is my destiny to make them unhappy. These are the roaches scurrying around in my mind when I turn on the lights in the kitchen of the proverbial house my mother built." Can you speak to that passage?
Yeah, that one is tough, and I'm actually very proud of it, the turns that it makes and how much it exposes while still kind of covering me and protecting me. It is one of the only passages that if I'm reading it to an audience, I'm either choking back tears or I just go for it and cry, or I try to cry ahead of time if I know I'm going to read it. That's a really tough thing to have one foot in believing that you shouldn't have done this and this is the thing that you are not just meant to do, but there's no way that I was not going to mother, right? And that would have been, maybe I would have just been that teacher that never goes home and has no boundaries or whatever form that would have taken. But I did really want to either adopt or give birth to children of my own, and not necessarily just to simply correct the loss and the lack of mothering, but because I was socialized, programmed, and had to survive by being a caretaker for so long as a little girl. And I got so good at it and so docile at it that I actually just wanted to be a caretaker as an adult and see what that feels like when things are reversed. So I'm never that needy, narcissistic child with my children as much as I can help it, the way that my father was. I mean, after my dad would severely beat me because he was off the rails, because he couldn't control himself, partially because of his own trauma, because society said it's okay to beat children and women, because he had a hot temper. I think maybe he might have been bipolar. The reasons are long, but I just remember the worst insult, the worst injury was that afterwards, you know, I would have like a shattered eye or I would just be sitting there sobbing. He himself would drape himself dramatically over a chair and cry and wail and, "Why did I do this to you? And I'm the worst and I'm so sorry." And then I would instinctively come over there and like pat him on the head and say, "That's okay." And all victims of violence or of any kind of abuse know that the worst part about all of it is actually the mixed messages, that wheel of the recovery and the honeymoon period and the stillness. And then sometimes we actually activate our abuser to hit us faster so we can get the tension phase over with. And so I was so aware of that pattern. I was so aware that my father not only was hurting me and creating conflict with me and not managing his own aggression, that then it was somehow in me to then console him. And I came at this process of mothering in general just knowing that I could never, ever, ever ask my kids to take care of me when it's my job to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping that we could finish by you describing maybe a feminist punk ideal life for yourself. I don't know, like, what would you sound like? What would the quality of your voice be? What languages would you speak? You know, what would you wear?
In some ways, like, I'm really just trying to live that life now and embody it and just be myself and just, you know, I'm turning 41 in like a week, and if I'm gonna wear like my cut off jean shorts with some black tights and some ratty clogs and get up on stage and read my work in my own kind of bratty, taunting way. Being myself is not a problem. It's being received, and mostly by men. Like, I think what I really, and also by women too. I think I'm in a scene in Portland where a lot of the women writers or just people in the literary scene are either managing their own high expectations with low rewards by either disappearing into themselves or harming themselves or throwing themselves at men or supporting men or enabling men that are toxic or corrupt or messed up. So, like, what my world really would look like if I had a dream world is if all these women said enough and they stopped backing up all these men, if we could expose all of the messed up stuff that happens at literary houses and bookshops and other places, and then the men could just take a seat and acknowledge the fact that they've messed up and that they've not been seeing us, supporting us, getting us, reading us, and just take a seat and finally let us have the stage. That's what my reality would look like.
Sofia Shalmiev emigrated from Leningrad to New York City in 1990. She's an MFA graduate of Portland State University with a second master's degree in creative arts therapy from the School of Visual Arts. She lives in Portland, Oregon with her two children. More information about her and her work can be found at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.